Future Proof Gold from News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof Gold. These are episodes from the past 10 years of the programme that we think deserve another listen, and that's why we're sticking them in your podcast feed. This was one of my favourites of the history of the programme that delved deep into the idea of gender, gender identity, and what it means to identify as a man or a woman or something in between. Enjoy. So when is a woman really a man? Can you be born with a penis and still be biologically female? There is in humans actually quite a wide spectrum of gender that is rarely discussed on the radio, but we're going to talk about it now. Alice Drager is a professor of clinical medical humanities and bioethics at the Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine. She's also written a book, Galileo's Middle Finger. Alice, welcome to the programme. How are you?
Good, thank you for having me.
Let's start off with the term ambiguous genitals. Can you explain what that is and what your area of research surrounds?
Sure. This is one of several types of intersex conditions. So intersex is when a person doesn't have the usual male anatomy or the usual female anatomy, but has something in between or something different. So that may mean that their sex chromosomes are different from the usual, or it may mean their insides don't match their outsides, or in the case of ambiguous genitalia, what it means is that their genitals developed between the male and the female type. And so that can mean that the phallus is not a clitoris or a penis, but is something in between. They may or may not have a vaginal opening. So it's kind of a, because males and females develop actually from the same tissues, but develop along two different pathways normally, you can actually go down the middle of that pathway and end up with something in between.
How common is this neither one nor zero, this non-binary sort of state as society has seen it, male or female? How common is that space in between?
Well, to decide the answer to that question, you have to figure out what you're going to accept as normal or abnormal, and that's very difficult to do. But if we look at the case of how many children are born in between enough that a specialist team is called in to try to figure out what sex the baby is, that would be about 1 in 2,000 births. And if we add in all the conditions, so when your chromosomes are different or there's something on the inside that's different, these may be very subtle things. If we add all of those together, about 1 in 100 people have some type of difference of sex development within their bodies.
Oh my goodness. I mean, I really didn't realize it was that common, but even 1 in 2,000 is an extraordinarily high number.
It is, and I was really surprised about that because I didn't hear about it at all when I was being raised, and yet once I started looking into it, it became clear that this was sort of a quiet thing known among pediatricians and known among physicians, but it wasn't talked about socially. That was in the mid-1990s. Today it's talked about a lot more. I mean, the 1 in 100 number would include even people who might not find out that they have any kind of intersex condition until they suffer from infertility and end up at an infertility clinic. They may find out that they have, for example, Klinefelter syndrome, which means a man has XY chromosomes instead of XY. So some of those things are pretty subtle, but when you add them all together, there's a lot of different ways that sex can develop.
So when we look at the causes for some of this ambiguity, as you call it, do we find that people associate with a particular gender because of a particular cause? So if it's something to do with the genes at birth, do people who, say, for example, have male genitalia but are mostly otherwise female, do they identify with one gender or another? Is there a pattern as to how people identify with one gender or another?
There is, and it tends to follow along the lines of prenatal androgens, which are a type of hormone that are thought of as a masculinizing hormone. We all make androgens, but females usually make fewer than males do. And so if you have these kinds of conditions and the fetus is exposed to, say, a high level, even though the fetus is otherwise female, the person may identify as male. If you have a lower level, may identify as female. But it's not a perfect match. So there's a bunch of play in the system, and it is possible that somebody can have a particular androgen level but not end up in the gender identity we would expect. So gender is not simple, but it does have a biological component for many of us.
Wow. I mean, I had never heard of this androgen level, yet essentially we always talk about what separates man and woman. You're essentially saying for most people, it's a level of this in our body that determines whether or not we consider ourselves male or female.
Well, that's part of it, but we also know that many people will identify with the gender they were assigned at birth and keep that gender, even if it turns out that the gender assignment wasn't in keeping with the androgen level you would have expected. So there's a lot of reason to think that upbringing does matter, but that biology also matters. So I'll just give you one example of a case or two cases where we know biology seems to matter. There's a group of women who have a condition called androgen insensitivity syndrome, and they have XY chromosomes, which are male typical. And when they were developing in the womb, they developed testes just like typical males. So they make lots of testosterone, which is a kind of androgen. So they make lots of the hormones that you would expect to have the body turn masculine. But they're lacking androgen receptors in their cells. So in other words, they're missing the kinds of cell receptors that would be able to respond to the testosterone. That's why they're called androgen insensitive. So the consequence is that because of that, they don't respond to the testosterone and the androgens. And so their bodies develop along the more typical female pathway on the outside. So they're born with typical female genitalia, and they have brains that are actually less androgenized than a typical female, because most females have androgen receptors. So their brains develop along much closer to the female pathway than the male pathway. And when they're born, most people don't even know that they have anything like this, because they look like typical girls. When they hit puberty, they go into the normal puberty level, so their testes produce more testosterone. But again, that's not having an effect on them. Some of that testosterone naturally turns into estrogen, so they develop along a feminine pathway because they are responsive to estrogen. And in that population, it's very, very rare to find anybody who identifies as male. So that suggests to us that androgens really matter. And another
I just need to follow up on that. You were saying sure. that these women develop as women, but essentially have a biological nature of them that is actually male.
Well, they have aspects of them that are definitely what we would think of as masculine. So they have XY chromosomes, and they have testes, unless a doctor takes them out. They have androgen levels that are high, like typical males. But because their cells don't respond to all of that, most of their body and their brains and their self-identity goes along a feminine pathway.
When you say they have testes, is that testes on the outside?
No, they're usually not descended. So you usually have to have a higher level of testosterone for your testes to descend. And since they're not responding to that testosterone, their testes are usually held inside the body. The consequence is when they
How on earth do we find these people? I mean, it sounds like you're talking about women who look like women and who
women.
Act like women and
are women,
born
yeah.
born as women. So
The reason they're found yeah. because they hit puberty and they start growing because they respond to the growth of puberty, and they grow breasts. And they look like typical girls developing in puberty. They grow feminine hips and feminine breasts, but they don't menstruate because although they have a vagina, inside there's no uterus and there's no ovaries. So what happens is they're 16 or 17 years old and they seem to be undergoing normal puberty, but there's been no menstruation. So they end up at a doctor's office, and when the doctor puts a speculum in, he or she will see that there's no cervix, there's no uterus, and that will tip them off, and then they'll do a genetic test which will confirm it.
Okay.
But it's quite often not picked up, actually, until puberty, because there's no other reason to think that these women have anything other than typical female development.
Wow. And your job, I suppose, has centered on how people have looked at this, the subject of intersex people, and how we've treated them. And I was wondering, from a scientific point of view, are we sexing children the wrong way at the moment by looking at their genitalia at birth? Is there a better way that we could sex our children, and should that inform how we raise them?
Looking at the genitals is actually a pretty good indicator of what happened to the brain, because genital development and brain development don't happen in exactly the same way, but usually if somebody's been exposed to a high level of androgens in the male typical pathway, then their genitals will look male and their brain will also be more male typical. And the same thing for the female in terms of low androgens will result in more female typical development in the genitals and also in the brain. So usually genitals are a pretty good indicator, and that's why it's worked so well for millennia, because we didn't know any of this, and yet it worked pretty well, because in most cases it's a pretty good indicator. But it's not always a perfect indicator. So you can have girls born with ambiguous genitalia or even masculine-type genitals who have a condition called congenital adrenal hyperplasia. And that's where their adrenal glands, which we all have in our backs, make so many androgens that they end up with a masculine typical development in terms of their genitals. In terms of their brain development, they tend to be sort of masculine, but some of them have been feminine. So some of it can become what unpredictable and difficult to predict. So that's one of the challenges in these cases for these children.
Have we tried historically to medically treat this ambiguity, to sort of force nature to go one way or the other? And in doing that, what have we done?
Adults have been really unhappy with ambiguous genitalia, historically speaking, and surgeons have tended to be called in, and children have been congenitally what I would call normalized, so made to look either typically male or typically female. And that usually means typically female because of the attitude that penises are fancy and vaginas are simple, which I think is a wrong attitude. I think they're both fancy.
Sorry, can you mean it's simpler to make a vagina than a penis?
Yes, there's one surgeon who trained his residents with the idea that it is easier to poke a hole than to build a pole. But vaginas are, in fact, more than a hole. They're actually fancy organs that have musculature and innervation, things like that. But historically, what's happened is they've tended to take the knife to these kids and make them look more female typical. And historically speaking, until recently, the children were also lied to. They weren't told what had happened to them. They were just told they were normal females. If it turns out they had been males, they told them they were infertile females, but they could adopt. So there was a whole system of withholding of information in here and actual lying to patients with the idea that nobody could handle knowing that they were born in between, so you had to do it this way.
Wow.
And that led to the intersex rights movement in the 1990s, which is what I ended up joining in the 1990s. I had done my dissertation work on what happened to people labeled hermaphrodites in the 19th century, so the 1800s in France and in Britain. And the folks who had been born with those conditions today started to contact me and ask me to help change the medical system in the United States. And it didn't occur to me it could be so bad, but when I looked at it, it was terrible. And so I thought it would be really easy to change it. And 20 years later, I'm still working with the medical system on changing it. But it's better today. There's less lying. There's better team care. There's an agreement that we shouldn't be doing these surgeries and should let children be raised as males and females, but recognize that we might get the gender assignment wrong. And so it's important to leave tissue in place so that they can decide for themselves whether to take the risks of surgery.
Is that the informed approach now, that if a child has ambiguous genitalia, that it's best to let them get to an age where they can tell you, I feel like a man or I feel like a woman, and then a surgery is done? Or is the thinking, let them decide, maybe they want to stay that way, but that decision shouldn't be taken from them as a child? Because, I mean, as a parent, spending your first 15, 16 years knowing that your genitalia was completely different from that you're seeing in biology books and in the showers in school, you know, you can totally understand why parents would want to shield their children from that.
Yes, it's a normal parental instinct to try to make sure every child looks typical and acts typical. I mean, it's why we teach children not to pick their noses and to say please and thank you. It's the same sort of motivation, is to make sure that they're socially acceptable. The problem with it is that the surgeries carry risk, and certainly carry a lot of risk if you've gotten the gender assignment wrong. And sometimes they take away fertility, they can take away sensation, they can leave permanent pain, permanent scarring. So there's significant risks associated with this. And today, particularly in Europe, even more so than in the United States, the attitude is that children should be allowed to grow up as boys or as girls, assigned with a best guess gender, which is what we do for everybody, is we guess as best as we can, and then let them decide for themselves whether or not they want to take on the risks of these surgeries. So you don't leave them socially isolated. You introduce them to other families with the same conditions, other kids and adults with the same conditions. You provide them psychosocial support. So you're not saying you just send them off into the world isolated. We actually provide lots of support now. But the UN, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture, has made very clear that he believes that intersex surgeries done for social reasons without the consent of the child are essentially a violation of human rights. The UN has been looking at this. The Swiss Bioethics Commission has issued a very strong report saying it's the right of the child to decide whether or not to have healthy genital tissue taken away. So it's really, there's a very strong movement in the direction of saying human beings have the right to decide the fate of their own bodies if there's not a medical emergency.
Alice Drager there, talking to us about a subject I have to admit I knew very little about, the broad spectrum of anatomy that is in the human species and intersex people.